NLP Health and Wellbeing, read by the authors Joseph O'Connor
and Ian McDermott.
Health and Wellbeing. Small words for a huge subject. Not just an interesting one, but one we live and breathe every day. They're real right now. They're very important. Health is not just a concept, it's an experience. So this tape is about your experience, not about health as an abstract value. What do you think about your health? What sort of experience is it? How do you experience your health and well-being? Is health feeling good, or is it not feeling bad? It's very tempting to define health as the opposite to illness. But is being healthy the same as not being ill? We don't think so. Health is much more. In our society, health is linked to medicine, and medicine means curing illness. Unfortunately, the Department of Health could be renamed as the Department of Illness, because that's what it deals with most of the time. Usually, we don't pay much attention to health and the accompanying feeling of well-being. They're like many of the good things of life. You only appreciate just how good they were when you lose them. You notice when they go, not when they're there. Then you wish you'd appreciated them more when you had them. Health isn't a thing that can be owned either, even though we talk about it in that way when we say, I have good health. But really, health's an experience that comes from the way our body and mind work together. Health isn't an all-or-nothing measure, something you have or haven't got. Our experience of health and well-being shifts and changes with the weather, with the state of our stomach, and the amount in our bank balance. Some days we feel great. Other days, just so-so, even though we may not be ill. So, this tape is not about avoiding illness, nor is it about curing disease. It's about how we can do more to create and enjoy our health and the feeling of well-being it gives us in everyday life. Being healthy doesn't mean not being ill. About 400 years before Christ, the Greek physician Hippocrates, regarded as the father of Western medicine, taught that being healthy was evidence that a person had achieved harmony within themselves and with their environment. Now, 2,500 years later, medical science is starting to agree with his view. Another example of historical figures stealing all our best ideas. Contemporary definitions of health come very close to Hippocrates. The World Health Organization defines health as the achievement of physical, psychological, and social well-being. There are three aspects in this definition. First, the physical, which is the one we notice the most. Then, the social. Health is about good and fulfilling relationships. And the third is the psychological. How healthy are your habitual thoughts and feelings? When you're physically healthy, you feel more positive, you think more clearly and creatively, you're more productive. When you get on well with people, you feel happier and you're likely to be healthier. All the three dimensions of health, the physical, the social, and the psychological, work together. They all influence each other. Medical science is just emerging from a period when it treated body and mind as separate things. We know now that they're so intimately connected that really they're different aspects of one person. You can't pull them apart. Two words, body and mind, making one person. The body isn't a machine with some little intelligent mannequin sitting in the brain pulling the levers. That's a ridiculous image, and yet sometimes we think like that. That's the image that comes to my mind when I hear someone say, pull yourself together. What am I supposed to be pulling? And who's doing the pulling?
You don't need to go to medical libraries for examples of how mind and body work together. Look at your everyday experience. Look at the instructions on medicine bottles telling you that the pills may cause drowsiness and you shouldn't drive or work with machinery. Illness affects how we think. Pain stops us thinking clearly. We don't make important decisions under the influence of drugs or medicine, if we've got any sense. and we know that decisions made in the pub under the influence of alcohol don't always look such a great idea the next morning. We also know the glow of well-being that comes from enjoyable physical exercise, the shivers down your spine when someone you love says they love you, and then there's that expansive feeling after a good meal. Thoughts and feelings affect us physically, and our physical states affect our thoughts and feelings. It's easy to see the effect of our physical state on our mental state. It's usually fast, direct, and obvious. Sometimes it's more difficult to make the connection in the other direction, how our thinking affects our physical health and well-being. Why? Because it happens more slowly. Like the movement of the minute hand on a clock, it's hard to see the movement. Every time you glance, it seems to be still. But you know it's moving because it changes over time. You see the movement in the contrast. Look at the lines on your face. They show your habitual expressions in your life. Your expressions are the result of your thoughts and emotions leaving traces on your face over the years. Your expressions prove that emotions have a physical effect over time. Look in a mirror every day, and you'll never notice the change from one day to the next. But look at a photograph of yourself a few years ago, and you'll immediately see the difference between then and now. Your mind is sensitive. It responds very quickly to what happens in your body. Your body usually changes more slowly in response to thoughts and emotions. It's hard to learn from experience if the effect comes a long time after the cause. It would be hard to make the connection between putting our hand on a hot stove and the resulting blister if the blister came up a week later instead of at the time. You'd keep getting mysterious blisters. There's a cause, but you wouldn't link it to the result. The modern science of psychoneuroimmunology researches the interaction between our immune system, our nervous system, and our states of mind, and it provides plenty of evidence of a link between our thinking, habitual emotions, and our physical health. Long-term positive states are good for your health. For example, a 9-year study that began in 1979 showed that people who had a good network of supportive friends and relatives had mortality rates between 2 and 5 times lower than those without this support. This lower death rate was independent of any other risk factors, such as smoking, and the link was the same for both men and women in every social group. Good relationships are good for your health. Harvard psychologist David McClelland showed a group of students a short film of Mother Teresa caring for the sick and dying on the streets of Calcutta. The immune systems of the students showed an increased response regardless of what the students thought of Mother Teresa. It seems that love and caring affects us at a deep physical level. There are also many studies of how constant negative emotions can undermine your health. Long-term negative states are bad for your health. Chronic anger and impatience puts people at an increased risk of a heart attack. Chronic depression is associated with both increased risk of heart problems and cancer. Depression makes our immune system less effective. One day, perhaps a doctor's prescription will not only be for a drug to be collected from the pharmacy, but will also have a recommendation for a comedy or romantic film we can collect from the local video store. Perhaps even for a book or tape from the local bookshop on building relationships or having more choice about your emotional state.
Our thoughts and emotional states affect our health. We look after our physical health in many ways, but don't pay so much attention to our thoughts. Negative ideas and states of mind take time to have their effect, but they do have an effect in the long run. Each one's harmless enough on its own, yet taken all together, they can be very powerful. It's the habits we form that have the greatest effect on our health. We know that chronic hostility over many months and years can lead to heart trouble. Constant stress, being bullied, living in difficult circumstances and a poor quality of life take their toll. They can lead to poor digestion, a depressed immune system response, and therefore more illness. Minor illness at first, but later, perhaps major illness. Doctors are increasingly treating patients' state of mind as well as their body during a critical illness. But why leave it so late? We stay clear of poisonous drugs, but not poisonous thoughts. We know the dangers of passive smoking, but what about passive thinking? Just watch old films of the Nazi rallies and see the infection of thousands of people with a poisonous idea. The effect of our thinking on our health and well-being is different for each person. We all respond in a unique way. Some people seem to thrive in stressful circumstances that would leave others a nervous wreck. Some people bear up under the weight of loss or misfortune, while others are crushed with depression. It's not what happens, it's our reaction to what happens that's important. Put two people in the same frenetic job, and one may become ill with stress, while the other relishes the challenge. What's happening? It's the same job for both, but not the same response. Stress, and all the bad physical effects that follow from it, come from our response to what happens, not the circumstances themselves. So, when you choose what you do and what you think, you're directly affecting your own health, because you're directly affecting your own biochemistry. You have the power to affect your biochemistry. Although not directly, you can't consciously make your heart beat faster by sheer willpower. But think of someone you love, and it'll speed up naturally. Your everyday choices influence your health. If you want more health and well-being, one answer is to pay more attention to your own experience, thoughts and emotions. I was driving into town a few weeks ago. It was a hot day. There was plenty of traffic on the road, but we were moving along nicely until suddenly we came to a halt. A truck had turned right awkwardly and blocked the road, and it was trying to manoeuvre round, but it didn't have enough room. The traffic on both sides had hemmed it in, leaving it no space, and the cars couldn't back up because of the cars behind them. The poor truck driver was trying to do a three-point turn, but it was turning out to be more like a 15-point turn. A long tailback formed. I was stuck in the queue with all the other cars waiting to get through, but there was nothing we could do until this truck had completed its turn. I idly glanced to my right. The man in the next car looked like he was going to burst. His face was red and contorted. He shook his fist at the truck and shouted something. I couldn't hear the words, but it didn't look like he was wishing the truck driver a long and happy life. I looked away to the man in the car behind him. The driver there was leaning back in his seat, sunning his face through the open sunroof. He looked quite happy. Eventually, the truck turned and the traffic started flowing again. I timed the hold-up. It lasted a shade over 3 minutes, although it seemed a lot longer. For 3 minutes, those two drivers were directly influencing their health in completely different ways. A hot day and a traffic hold-up can be annoying, but you can choose your response. Suppose someone had said to the first apoplectic motorist before he drove off in the morning, "Here's a syringe of drugs. They'll raise your blood pressure, disturb your digestion, lower your immune system response, and make you feel upset. As soon as you see a red truck, I want you to inject them into your arm." Would he have done that? I don't think so. But how he reacted had the same effect. We can all sympathize with him, and most of us have reacted as he did in a traffic delay. I know I have. But if this is a habit, then he's not doing his health any good in the long run.
So how do we enhance our health and well-being? There's plenty we can do physically by avoiding unhealthy habits. For example, don't smoke or get badly sunburned, and make sure you avoid exposure to radioactivity and strong magnetic fields. And there are plenty of positive actions too. Eat well and get sufficient exercise. However, being healthy isn't the same as being fit. Fitness is the capacity to take in oxygen and engage in greater physical effort. Fitness depends on muscle strength, stamina, and flexibility. You can be very fit, but not healthy. Moderate regular exercise is healthy. Too much exercise weakens the immune system. If you over-exercise, you get less healthy, not healthier. Many athletes damage their health in the pursuit of fitness. Their training routine may also lead to a diminished social life, less satisfying relationships, and proneness to injury. This too can be hazardous to their health. What about the habits of thought? What thought habits should we avoid, and what habits should we cultivate? We do not have total control over our lives, and we aren't to blame for being ill, but we can do a lot to enhance our health and well-being. We have more control than we give ourselves credit for. I don't know if you've ever been involved in something very important that really matters to you. You want to finish it. You have to finish it. You can't afford to be ill, and you're not, until the project is finished. Then perhaps you come down with a cold or flu. It's almost as if you give yourself permission to be ill afterwards. There are some interesting examples of this experience on a large scale. In 1973, doctors in Israel went on strike. Admission to hospital went down by 85%. The death rate dropped by 50% and reached its lowest recorded level. The previous low was 20 years earlier, also during a doctor's strike. When it matters, we do seem to be able to influence our health. Neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP, is about how we create and experience our internal world. NLP is a great resource for creating a mental environment that will increase our health and well-being. Our beliefs and values about health are an important part of our experience. What we believe and what's important to us guide our actions. How important is your health to you? What are you prepared to do to keep it? How important is it to others? If you were ill, what effect would it have on you and others? Do you value your health, or do you value not being ill? Dealing with stress is a major part of staying healthy, and feeling stressed is the opposite to well-being. Stress is created not by what happens to you, but by how you respond to what happens to you. How can you have choice over your response? A lot of stress comes from fretting about something that cannot be changed, rather than getting on and dealing with the consequences. There are three main steps to dealing with stress effectively. The first is to find out how and when stress affects you. There are the obvious times, like losing your temper in a traffic jam. But there are also other times. The pressure builds up gradually. And because it builds up gradually, it's hard to see. Maybe the driver's reaction in the traffic jam was the result not just of that minor inconvenience. Maybe that was the last straw in a day of arguments and frustration. You want to be able to see what happens before it reaches this stage. What's the signal for you that you're under stress? It could be biting your nails, smoking more than usual, eating more than usual, persistent stomach aches, feeling generally impatient or annoyed over little things. When you feel stressed, first, acknowledge it. You may think you shouldn't feel stressed, but stress happens. Some health advice could actually make you feel worse because it implies you can completely control yourself. So when you get ill or stressed, it suggests it's all your fault. That's adding insult to injury, and that sort of advice doesn't help. We do not have complete control. We only do what we can when we can. So acknowledge how you feel, without trying to change anything just yet. This can be a great relief, because we often skip over this step in favor of feeling bad about being stressed, and that creates a vicious circle. The second step is to take a mental step aside and look at what's happening from a different perspective. We think about what happens to us in two ways. One is when we're inside the event, experiencing it directly. We feel the emotions. This is called being associated. Being associated is great for pleasant experiences. Whenever you want to relive or think about a pleasant experience, associate into it. Think of it as if it were happening again. Be there. See it again through your own eyes. When you want to put some distance between you and the experience, look at it from the outside. See yourself from outside the situation. Then you can be more objective and learn from it. This is called being dissociated. Sometimes we don't learn from painful experience because we think we have to go back and relive it again in our imagination. And once really was more than enough. When you want to learn from an experience, especially a painful one, make sure you're dissociated from it when you recall it. See yourself there. Use this principle to distance yourself from possible stress. Look at the situation as an outside observer, rather than from the inside where you're caught in your reaction. Stress puts you in a state of mind that makes it hard to deal with the problem that's causing it. It's hard to deal with a problem in the state of mind that the problem has induced in you. You're not at your best. You have to step outside it. The fuming driver in the traffic jam looked as if he was totally caught up in the problem. One thing he might have done was to get out of the car for a moment. Giving himself more space might have given him more mental space to think as well. There are many ways you can step outside the situation in your mind. Imagine you're seeing it on a film. See it as if it's happening to you rather than feeling it happening to you. It might be a tragedy or a comedy, but you're in the audience watching yourself on the screen. This doesn't change the event, but it does help you to react differently. It's easier to deal with. There are always two aspects to any stressful incident. One is the consequence out in the world. The other is the damage it does to your health by your stress reaction. Whatever you do to deal with the real consequences, you can minimize the effect of the stress on your health and well-being by thinking about it differently. Once you have stepped outside the problem, the third step is to decide what to do about the problem. Is there anything you can do directly? How much influence do you have? We all have an area of concern and an area of influence. Our area of concern is what affects us. Our area of influence is what we can affect. It's where we can make a difference directly. And it's a much smaller part of our area of concern. So when you look at the situation, is it in your area of influence? If it is, then start thinking about what resources you may have to deal with it. Look at the stressful incident. What does it mean? What other meaning could this experience have? What are the consequences? Can you do anything about it directly? How can you deal with any unpleasant consequences? What resources do you have to deal with it? Is there anyone you know who could help you? Think about what they would do. Does it give you any ideas?
Worry is one source of stress. It's bad enough when something bad happens, but worrying makes it worse. Worse still is to worry about something that hasn't happened. We can worry about anything, even if it hasn't happened and is very unlikely to happen. Worry has a structure. People who are good at worrying tend to do it the same way. They may not like the results they get, but that's a different matter. They've perfected the art of imagining how something can turn out badly. They can make mental pictures so real and vivid that they alter their body chemistry and feel anxious and upset. Now, that ability to make vivid pictures is a talent that could be employed in a much better way. For example, what would it be like to imagine pleasure and success and feel how good that was? There are always more ways that a situation can go wrong than there are ways for it to go right. Just as there are more ways for a room to be untidy than there are for it to be tidy. On the second side of this tape, you'll have a chance to find out how your own worry strategy works and how to change it if you want to. We're looking here at how worry works, not what you worry about. Regardless of the subject of worry, how people worry tends to have some common features. First of all, there's a lot of thinking, but usually no action. Worry is one way the brain ticks over, like an idling car engine. You get all the unhealthy exhaust gases without the benefit of going anywhere. Once you do take